This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 11th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Matt Allagher and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the best of the past week's news and analysis programmes from Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, we hear why Israel and Iran just can't see eye to eye over the historic talks that took place recently in Switzerland.
I think Israel is going to have to come around, whether it likes it or not, to Iran having a nuclear program. There's nothing Israel really can do about it.
Also ahead in the program,
it's a real mix, and a lot of people still don't know, which I think is interesting. And there's been a lot of Green Party support. There's been, you know, a little bit of UKIP to people that are saying they don't want to vote, which is also part of the story itself.
We hear from one of the UK's most close-run areas for election success, with photographers capturing the voting habits of its residents. That's all coming up and much more in the next half hour, right here on The Recap with me, Matt Allagher. When a preliminary deal on Iran's nuclear future was finally struck in Switzerland last week, many exhaled a sigh of relief. But a further deadline lies ahead. It's by June the 30th this year, and that final deal must be reached in order to prevent Iran potentially building a nuclear weapon. Among the issues still plaguing the debate is Israel's demand that a deal relies on that state being recognised by Tehran. But that's something President Obama effectively doused in ice-cold water earlier this week in an interview with NPR. So, can a deal be struck that satisfies both Israel and Iran? On The Briefing show on Wednesday, foreign affairs journalist and author of City of Lies, Love, Sex, Death and the Search for Truth in Tehran, Ramita Navai, visited the studios at Midori House to mull over the question.
When it comes to Israel, Israel says absolutely no to a nuclear program, even if it's peaceful. Zero centrifuges, zero uranium enrichment. And we mustn't forget, actually, that America held the same position stance in 2003. And Iran is saying what's changed is that America has moderated its demands. Israel still hasn't. So America, the US, has accepted that Iran has the capability and the know-how and says it's completely unrealistic to want Iran to accept that Iran should scrap its nuclear program.
So could there be an agreement between the two?
There could absolutely never be an agreement between Israel and Iran, partly because the regime's rhetoric is based on an anti-Israeli rhetoric. Anti-Israeli rhetoric is what kind of revolutionary values that help the regime hold on to power based on. Iran needs an enemy to unite its people. Israel is that enemy. But kind of on a less existential level, the regime truly does believe that Israel is an illegitimate state, that it's occupying Muslim land, and that it's killing Muslims. And of course, Israel would never accept a rapprochement with Iran until Iran stopped funding, arming groups like Hezbollah and Hamas. And that's not about to happen yet.
Now, if Iran did renege on the deal, if it all went ahead, but then they broke the agreement, how quickly could sanctions be reintroduced?
We don't know this yet because the final deal, as you said, hasn't been announced. But what's clear is that, and Obama has said this, that some of the sanctions will be reversible. So what we understand so far is that all EU sanctions will be lifted immediately. US sanctions will be phased out over the next 6 months to a year. And what we understand at this point is that some of these US sanctions, including things like banking, sanctions on banking, will be reversible.
We've already seen a huge impact, obviously, on relations between the US and Israel over this. Are they likely to deteriorate further?
Probably not. It depends on what the final agreement is. And also, I think Israel is going to have to come around, whether it likes it or not, to Iran having a nuclear program. There's nothing Israel really can do about it.
What about other Middle Eastern states? Obama's pledged to host a conference at Camp David with various other interested parties. Is this just appeasement or what the neighbours say really matters?
What the neighbours say does really matter, especially what's happening now in the Middle East, in Syria, with Iran's involvement in Iraq. Of course, Saudi is not going to be happy. So much of this has got to do with Iranian regional power, as with national pride. So I think Obama has is absolutely, you're absolutely right, has got a job to appease some of Iran's rivals.
Mm. What about Congress? The White House has gathered a really impressive array of people to talk up the deal. I think over 50 ex-diplomats and foreign affairs specialists and so on. Very impressive names on the list. Can they prevent the naysayers who are trying to scupper the deal?
They can. Exactly the same is happening. It's being mirrored in Iran at the moment. So the commander of the Revolutionary Guards has just spoken out in favour of the deal. So really, this deal is wanted on both sides. And it's going to be very hard to scupper. It is still possible. Until that final agreement is signed, anything is possible. Unlikely, but possible.
That was foreign affairs journalist Ramita Navaid. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. China's economy might have slowed a little in the past year, but it would be hard to argue it's losing its appeal as a place to do business and become a success. However, for the Chinese, opportunities abroad hold a lot of appeal for those wealthy enough to make a new life. A recent survey of well-off Chinese revealed that 64% of respondents plan to move overseas in the near future. For Monday's Globalist, Monocle's Justin Bergman went to Shanghai and Beijing to meet some of those planning to leave.
Choi Wu is typical of many 20-somethings in modern China. Growing up in a small city, Choi viewed education as the key to a better life and studied hard to get into a top Chinese university. Then, like many ambitious students, he went abroad to pursue a master's degree in the UK. Though he graduated just a few years ago and isn't even married yet, Choi is already thinking about how he will provide the best education for his own children. Meeting me for coffee after work one day in Shanghai, he tells me his plan. For the next few years, he's going to save money and get serious about dating so he can find a wife. Then, he will leave China.
My university in China was not bad, but I don't think I received much practical knowledge. I have a younger brother studying in Britain and a friend in Singapore, and their courses are more diverse and have a better combination of practice and theory. In Chinese people's perspective, immigration to another country is for the next generation, not the current one.
May I have your attention, please? United Airlines flight UA087.
Choi is not alone in wanting to leave China. For those with the means to do so, getting permanent residency in another country is becoming as desirable as buying an apartment or a luxury car. According to a survey conducted last year by the Hurun Report, which tracks the habits of wealthy Chinese, 64% of respondents said they had already emigrated or were planning to emigrate in the near future. But why are so many Chinese wanting to move overseas? To find out, I visited the Beijing offices of one of the leading immigration consulting agencies in China, WellTrend United. It was a typically smoggy day in Beijing, and not surprisingly, the company's vice president, Victor Lam, told me that China's poor air quality is a major factor.
You hit the nail on the head with one of the top reasons, pollution, and if I may say, generally speaking, quality of life. The pollution's there. Many applicants feel there are too many people, too many cars, it's always crowded, the traffic and what have you. Other factors, food quality, food safety. There are serious concerns about that. Education system. Many parents are concerned that their children are not getting the quality education that they would otherwise get in the West. They're in classrooms with classroom sizes of 50, 60, and upwards.
Fortunately for the rich would-be immigrants in China, there are a host of countries around the world that are willing to sell permanent residency at the right price. The United States, for instance, has an investor program called EB-5 that is popular among wealthy Chinese. Invest $500,000 in a business that creates 10 jobs, you get a green card. European countries that were hit hard by the global economic crisis have fewer requirements. Victor Lum ticks off some of the places that are popular among his clients.
In the past couple of years, I believe Cyprus was one of the first to promote permanent residence to their country via the acquisition of real estate, minimum value amount of 300,000 euro. We've got countries like Portugal, for example, with a similar scheme, a minimum investment of 500,000 euro.
And going a bit further to the east, can result in huge savings.
Currently, we find our most popular European program is the Hungarian Residency Bond Program. In a nutshell, it's the it's a program that gives permanent residence if you purchase a bond for 300,000 euro. What makes it attractive is that applicants can get back 250,000 euro of this investment after 5 years.
For most Chinese emigrants, one country remains the promised land, Canada. Canada's investor immigration program was so popular, in fact, the government had to scrap it last year in face of a backlog of nearly 70,000 applicants. But there is a backdoor into the country through Quebec. The province sets its own immigration policies, and the investment amounts are far less than the new federal requirements. And if a potential investor can speak French, he or she can skip to the front of the queue.
Oui, mais je ne comprends pas mon chien et c'est...
For some French students at the AAA International Language School in Shanghai, emigration is the long-term goal. Here's Jackie Wong, the school's coordinator.
It's for immigration. Their purpose is very obvious and apparent. Because English is the dominant language in Canada, there's no point to study there if it's not for immigration. It's just like going to a hot pot restaurant, but asking for a hamburger.
The same is true of the United States. Every day outside the American consulate in Shanghai, a line of visa applicants begins forming at 7 a.m. Many of them are young people, like Yue Xia, who is studying at a university in California. But unlike most, she doesn't want to stay when she's finished with her studies.
Many young people think the education system in the U.S. is better and maybe it's easy to find a job when we graduate. I want to go back to China. Yeah, okay.
Is it a dream of yours to live in the U.S.?
Not for me. I prefer China.
For Monocle in Shanghai and Beijing, I'm Justin Bergman.
That was Monocle's Justin Bergman reporting from Shanghai and Beijing on The Globalist here on Monocle 24. You can catch the show every weekday from 7 a.m. London time. A month from now, we'll be counting the ballots in Britain's general election. And in one of the tightest races the UK has ever seen, none is tighter than the London constituency of Hampstead and Kilburn. Last time, the Labour Party won by just 42 votes. On one side of Hampstead and Kilburn sits Hampstead, home of the champagne socialists of the mid-90s Labour Party. On the other, Kilburn, much less opulent and home to many of London's immigrant communities. Two photographers, Joseph Fox and Orlando Gilley, have set out to document the battle for Hampstead and Kilburn, posting two new portraits every day of voters as they explain which way they're leaning. Orlando spoke to Monocle's Andrew Muller and Paul Osborne on Tuesday's edition of the Monocle Daily to tell us a bit more.
Kilburn, like all of London, central London is getting more and more expensive to live in. It's still visibly rougher than the Hampstead side.
Everywhere is visibly rougher than Hampstead.
That's true. It's got the biggest Irish immigrant population in London, which is its traditional roots, and now it's got lots of African immigrants, Somali. So it still is notably different, but there are, you know, lots of nice patches within as well.
So in terms of your project, how do you go about selecting the Hampstead and Kilburn voters you photograph? Have you just been walking the streets of the constituency thinking, ah, oh, they look interesting, and asking if they'll pose for a picture?
Exactly.
And you find out their political story afterwards. So it's a sort of straw poll.
Yeah, it's a little bit. You feel a bit like someone, you know, who's collecting money for a charity, stopping people on the streets in that way, because people are initially quite, rightly so, quite suspicious. Why is someone asking if you live in Hampstead and Kilburn? Which is how the conversations always start.
You were saying, you know, we were saying at the beginning, this is one of the tightest races in the election, certainly in London. There were only 800 votes between first and third place, and basically the three big parties roughly got about one third of the vote each last time. Let's use your unscientific sample of the people that you've taken portraits of and spoken to so far, and you're going to carry this on through the campaign, I know. You know, how do you think it's looking now?
I think it's, you know, different areas, you know, Hampstead Town, you know, up by Hampstead Heath, which is where I was, the last place I went to. I came across a lot of Conservatives, young and old, And other days I've come across, in other areas, I've come across different parties have been supported by the people I've photographed. So it's a real mix. And a lot of people still don't know, which I think is interesting. And there's been a lot of Green Party support. There's been, you know, a little bit of UKIP to people that are saying they don't want to vote, which is also part of the story itself.
You must, to some extent, I suppose, you line someone up, they agree to have their portrait taken, you take the picture, and in your head, with the best will in the world, to some extent, you must think, oh yeah, I've got you marked down as a Conservative, or I think you're going to be a Labour voter. Have you had anything where you've asked them then what they're thinking about the election, who they're thinking they're going to vote for, and you've just been floored by the response, just something you didn't expect?
It's hard to tell whether someone's going to stop and take part and be up for it, but in terms of someone's political persuasion, I think I normally have a bit of a gut instinct as to what
that's
be.
That's quite interesting in itself, though. What are the visual cues for a Liberal Democrat voter, for example? Is it the stereotypical sandals and beard?
I have yet to come across a Liberal Democrat. Joe has come across one.
That in itself bodes ill for the Liberal Democrats.
That tells us something right there.
Yeah.
I have yet to find a Liberal Democrat in a seat where they got one third of the votes last time.
Yeah, I think exactly. So hopefully, even though it's, you know, hyper-local and it's London-centric, it might give a tiny indication as to the mood on the streets.
That was our Andrew Muller and Paul Osborne talking to photographer Orlando Gilley. You're listening to The Recap. Up next, a sneak peek at the new Apple Watch.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism, at Monocle 24 we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. David Phelan was on Wednesday's Monocle Daily to talk about a new timepiece. Elegant, friendly, it whispers craftsmanship. But enough about our technology correspondent. These descriptions have been applied to the new Apple Watch, which has just been released to members of the press to have a play with. Over to Andrew Muller, Emma Nelson and David Phelan to enjoy the world's first radio review of the Apple Watch.
It's excellent. It's the thing about it not being intuitive, there is an element in that. It's not quite as immediately usable as a lot of Apple gadgets are, but it really grows on you and very quickly becomes essential. And it's, you know, it's a curious thing because one of the things it does many things, is it transfers notifications from your iPhone to the watch, which doesn't sound that great, right?
Well, no, because this is what I don't understand about it.
You're going to be chased by my arm.
Yeah, I have an iPhone.
Well, you know how it is when you're in a restaurant and you see people and they're not even talking to each other. They've just got their faces in their iPhones, checking their notifications.
Doesn't happen at my table.
Okay. But a lot of people do it. And people who are obsessive about checking their notifications, this is great for, because instead of when a buzz goes off or you think something's happening, you grab your phone. None of that happens anymore. You get the gentlest tap on your wrist and you lift it to your face and you see what that notification is. And it's a much less immersive experience.
Isn't it potentially, though, even more annoying? Because the thing is, as it is with an iPhone, if you go to a restaurant, you decided I'm going to sit down and be sociable, you stick your phone in your coat pocket, you hang your coat up, it's like, fine, I'm here, I'm paying attention to these people. But you don't take a watch off. It's always there. You would never escape.
No, but you know what? You can just glance down, see if it's that email you really wanted, and if it wasn't, I think it keeps you connected to the digital world without disconnecting you from the real world. And I think that's what you don't get if you've got a tablet or an iPhone in front of you. And for me, that's the thing that I now barely check my iPhone for messages, because here it is on my wrist, and it's kind of just enough detail for what I need. I can get more, or if I need to do something more complex, I can go back to the phone.
You mentioned the fact that it seemed to be more subtle and discreet, but what part of the Apple Watch has actually surprised you, either for good or for bad?
I think the most exciting thing that I have found that I keep using is directions. Often I know exactly where I'm going, but I'm just doing it for the sake of it. But you just speak your destination into the watch, tell it you want to walk, and it will find the map and give you directions turn by turn, and it taps you on the wrist when you're coming to a junction to say whether you're to turn left or right, and it's a different tap for left or right. So you don't have to have your phone out in a kind of sketchy part of town late at night. You never need to look like a tourist again.
So it's out in the next few weeks. Is this something that you tell us all to buy now, or do we wait for the upgrade?
I think it's a good purchase now. The thing is that it's like the iPad. When it first arrived, no one knew what it was, what it would do. Well, that turned out all right. And it's partly because the apps are what will define it. And I've only seen 20 or 30 of them because the App Store isn't open yet. It opens on the 24th. And I think in the next few months, we'll expect to see extraordinary apps that will define what the watch can do.
That was David Phelan, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson pushing a few buttons on Wednesday's Monocle Daily. Tune in every weeknight from 2200 hours UK time for debate on the day's latest stories. We end today's programme on a satirical note. Following the recent appointment of Trevor Noah in the US to fill the enormous shoes of the country's top satirist, The Daily Show's Jon Stewart, our series this week is looking at satire and its health around the globe. Conservatives might be breathing a sigh of relief to see the back of Stewart, but is satire, kicking against the bigger targets by its very nature, an essentially liberal pursuit? On Monday's edition of The Globalist, Monocle's Henry Rees Sheridan spoke with New York-based writer and contributor to The Atlantic, Oliver Morrison, to find out just that.
Welcome to The Daily Show!
When you're talking about the most famous kind of satire right now, TV satire, it's basically a team sport. And so you have a whole bunch of writers and comedians and different people that have to get together to quickly turn around the news, make it into something funny, and package it for television. And just the fact is that there are just so many more comedians that tend to be liberal than there are conservative that it's just really hard to staff a show full of conservative comedians that have that sort of tendency. Some people say that satire tends in its form to be more liberal because liberals tend to champion the downtrodden or people that aren't represented, whereas conservatives conserve institutions. They're interested in defending the status quo, which is antithetical to what satire usually is, which is, you know, making fun of the powerful and trying to bring them down a peg. People who are defending the status quo have to use a different form in order to break down, you know, the things that they're railing against. It just, you can be angry about things changing, things looking different, things being uncomfortable from the way you like them, but it's hard to couch that into a joke that's funny for everyone if, you know, there aren't, you know, some basic truths or principles of justice behind it or something like that.
Oh, all these global tensions must be tightening your shoulders. Let me just bite a little bit of your hair. Yum, 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 yum.
Part of my thesis, I think, is that the liberal satire shows are, in some sense, performing a very similar function, a cathartic function for liberals as conservatives are. So I think one of the reasons why those satire shows are successful is that there was a craving for it, especially when the world seemed to be going crazy in America with the Iraq war and such, that liberals just needed some sort of cathartic release to get rid of all of their anger and frustration. So they found themselves having those same needs that conservatives had and were having.
Should we be doing more to make the war in Iraq more eco-friendly?
Absolutely. I mean, right now, each country that's engaged in a war is sending in their own separate troop transports. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why we're not simply carpooling.
There have been studies done that show that liberals and conservatives respond to different kinds of art differently. And so when liberals were looking for that sort of cathartic release, they're not so much interested in sort of simplistic, straightforward answers. They like things that are more ambiguous and full of irony. They prefer to have two ideas juxtaposed in their mind at the same time, whereas conservatives tend to prefer having maybe a single thought, a clear thought, straightforwardness rather than duplicity.
I mean, don't take it wrong. I'm on the team, the conservative team. I'm an independent conservative. The challenge is, how do you get people to listen to you every day? Well, you got to go beyond Obama's a communist, Obama's a Marxist, Obama bit. All true.
There might be like a, you know, sort of an internal aesthetic reason. That's something that's being investigated right now, that conservative tending people prefer one kind of art and liberals another. So many of the modern forms of comedy that we think of as comedy, like sketch comedy, improv comedy, stand-up comedy, satire, you know, satirical news sites, all of that is so new in a way. It's like two generations old, so it's hard to like separate it out from our sort of modern political context. Not that satire itself isn't as old, you know, hundreds of years old. You know, it's possible that we're conflating some of our current political biases with the form it's taking now. I think there's some sense in which that radio and that talk form, even though that both forms are rely on a certain kind of catharsis, that conservative talk radio depends on it even more. And so the idea that people calling in and being able to vent off and be able to hear a version of themselves being frustrated and angry might work better for that. Whereas liberals, I think it is true that the reason the shows have been so successful and the reason they're more successful in times where things are really frustrating, such as the Iraq War, is because they're looking for some catharsis. But I also think that the idea is that they're looking for clarity, maybe in a certain kind of way, that, like, you know, maybe the liberals are searching for answers in some respect rather than looking for validation.
It really seems the bigger story here is not will Iran get a nuclear weapon, and more the world needs Netanyahu's anti-aging secret, because
I feel like there's a moment right now with the internet in particular where so much of the stuff that seems to get popular on the internet or that goes viral in the media is stuff that, you know, someone's offended, someone does something offensive. And so I think there is something to the fact that liberals might have a harder time accepting their own imperfections in a way. You know, like even Patricia Arquette during her Oscar speech recently gave a speech that was sort of in support of women's rights, but people sort of picked it apart as being not totally inclusive.
Thank you to the Academy, to my beautiful, powerful nominees, to every woman who gave birth and equal rights for women in the United States of America.
And so I think that there is definitely an emphasis on carefulness and not being offensive. I think that's definitely more of a liberal trait right now. So maybe that's the case, that it's just harder for liberals. It's certainly been the case in terms of, like, you know, on TV, MSNBC is the big liberal news channel in the U.S., and they've struggled a lot, especially relative to Fox. So it does seem like the kind of the spouting off political form, I guess, isn't just radio. That has continued to be sort of a conservative form on TV as well.
That's all we've got time for on this week's episode of The Recap. The show was produced by Tom Hall and edited by Sam Impey. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programmes here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Matt Alagaya, thank you for listening. Goodbye.